Okay, thanks very much for the opportunity to talk today. What I'm going to do is talk in two halves. The first will be about where we are with the fine mapping, and then I'll talk about some further developments in some of our starch modification work. So I'm going to run through this very quickly, but I think we've had enough talk from Andreas and then Mike to indicate that we're very interested in manipulating starch content, structure and functionality for a whole range of end uses, the nutritional, the food functionality, etc. So that's one of the drivers here. And then we have a whole raft of methods and principles for analysing starch structure and functionality. And I won't go into all of those, but I'll give a couple of examples where we've used these in our genetics experiments. And then I'll just point out a recent paper from Regina looking at the relationships between a range of these parameters. And I guess an overarching conclusion from that work is around confirming the importance of the amylase and myelopectin ratio, but also the fine structure of amylopectin as drivers of a number of the parameters that we're interested in modifying. So yesterday, Colin Kavanagh talked about a whole program that we have around molecular mapping of wheat properties, and I'll just touch on that around QTL mapping and the potential to then move into marker-assisted selection for wheat traits. We also have, in parallel with that in our lab, a program of using molecular genetics, so candidate gene identification, using transgenic breeding to generate diversity, but also, very importantly, using the knowledge that's generated from that transgenic breeding to go back and make specific modifications through conventional breeding. Because that is a much more rapid and straightforward mechanism of taking the science to the consumer. So in terms of the mapping population, what I'm going to talk about quickly is some work from a four-way magic population. So for those of you who weren't in the talk yesterday, it's a multi-parent advanced generation intercross. And basically what's different here is we're taking four different germplasm pools represented by four cultivars, intercrossing those according to a very defined crossing program, and being able to then accurately map the genes controlling various characters. So from an Australian perspective, those four lines came from our four major production zones, and our estimate is that this covers or encompasses about 80% of the allelic genetic or diversity in the Australian breeding populations. And the way these crosses are made is through, as I said, a very defined set of intercrosses. So at the bottom there, every progeny line has all four parents in roughly equal measure in its pedigree. Okay, so just to give you a snapshot of what's coming out of that is some work to look at four parameters, and it's amazing how many times you can look at the slides and not pick up the spelling mistake. and a number of people saw these slides and didn't see it either, so that's interesting. Starch content, amylase and myelopectin, the peak viscosity and the final viscosity. So just to indicate, in this experiment, there's about 750 progeny lines, and then I'm marking on there the phenotype of the parental material. So I wanted to make a couple of points. Firstly is that these four magic parents are covering quite wide phenotypic diversity as well as genetic diversity. So there's quite a spread there in terms of these phenotypes. But the second point I'd like to note is that there is quite significant transgressive segregation in the tails of these populations, so that we are getting through combinations of genes that are not in the release varieties quite additional variation. So they can see starch content, amylose content, the peak viscosity, and then the final viscosity. So having done all of that, the QTL analysis, just want to draw out a couple of points. There's a lot of sort of summary level data here. There was some good QTLs that we're following up for starch content in terms of four chromosomal locations. Amylose content, there were a number of contributors to amylose, but in wheat and confirmed in this population, really the major locus driving amylose content there was the granule-bound starch synthase. So it doesn't mean that other genes aren't important, it just means that there isn't much genetic diversity for the other genes in the starch synthesis pathway. Again, in the peak viscosity, and that should say final viscosity, again, a number of other QTLs, but the GBSS is very important. So some conclusions, the genetic control of these starch properties is complex. A number of those QTL do sit on top of known starch genes, but equally a good half to two-thirds of them don't have a known starch biosynthesis gene underneath those QTL. So you can well imagine that there are other genes controlling things like peak viscosity and so on that are not starch biosynthetic genes, and so that'll be an area of future work. And then I mentioned the importance of the GBSS. Several of those parents there have a known null mutation in chromosome 4A for GBSS. A couple of things, though, I want to point out, and this will lead to the second part of the talk, is that we really didn't achieve very high levels of amylose in here, only got up to about the 35% mark. Quite interesting, with a single null 4A allele in here, we got lines with very low amylose. So there's some interesting genetics to be followed up to understand what's driving that suppression of amylose in a subset of these lines. But if we're really interested in achieving the high amylose and to follow on and show where we're taking the high amylose starch forward, really additional sources of genetic variation are required. So I'm going to touch on a couple of examples. Mike touched on a couple of these around ways of generating genetic diversity by going directly to the gene, either the GBSS here or the starch synthase 2A, which is the SGP gene that was mentioned in Durham, and to identify and combine mutations. And here what you can see as a general principle is that it's really only until you get the three loci with mutations that you get a significant change in phenotype at the level of composition, although it is worth noting that in the GBSS example, single nulls have quite important and powerful changes in functionality, even though the amylose content change is very small. So just to point out here, you can generate with a single gene eight genotypes, the wild type, single nulls, double nulls, triple nulls as a resource. So our interest for many years has been to generate high amylose, and in wheat there are three genes. We first showed a long time ago now that branching enzyme 1 mutations when combined don't lead to any significant change in amylose content. So we then went on and published in 2006 in bread wheat, I think a few years before the Durham work there that was mentioned previously, the use of RNAi technology to generate high amylose lines using the RNAi technology, and that was published in PNAS in 2006. Other attempts have been used to use the mutation approach to generate non-transgenic high amylase wheat, and but they haven't yet achieved comparable levels of amylase to the target levels there around the 75% mark. And so there's some issues with doing this in wheat for those of you who aren't wheat geneticists. The first of those is that we have three genomes, so we have to, as I pointed out previously, you have to find simultaneous mutations. We also have two genes that can potentially influence amylase content, starch branching enzymes 2A and 2B. But to add a delicious third element of complexity, they're extremely tightly linked. So they're within about a quarter of a centimorgan. So that means that to find individual mutations and then to recombine them is an extremely challenging task. So an approach that we've taken has been to use a variety of mutagenesis techniques to identify individual mutations in either the SBE2A gene or the 2B gene, or mutations that simultaneously affect both genes. And this has been combined with an approach of not just relying on the at the DNA level predictions of what these mutations would do, but actually using techniques to define the impact on the protein. So for these branching enzymes, very difficult to assay these enzymes quantitatively. So we're using a Western blot approach, using affinity gel electrophoresis to separate out the three different homeoform products on the basis of very fine differences in their kinetic properties. And you can see here that we're able to separate out the D, A and B genome forms, and then we can generate single or double or triple mutants using conventional crossing techniques. So then when we move on to use that, just to summarise a lot of work here quickly, the wild type range 25 to 30, adding a single mutation will give a very slight increase in amylase content. Double mutants, you can get a noticeably but still not in the target range increase. And in fact, combining the three branching enzyme 2A mutants doesn't get you to the amylase content where the resistant starch level is in the target range. So here's our transgenic control. And then we have moved on using combinations of the branching enzyme 2A mutants and 2B mutants to generate non-transgenic wheats with amylose contents in the range of 75 to 85. So the focus of where we're going this with this work is to take this material through to the use in the marketplace based on the achievement of the target amylose content and the freedom that having a non-transgenic produces. So a lot of studies now ongoing in terms of starch structure and functionality, and just to show that there are very significant effects on myelopectin structure here in terms of chain length distribution. So just to point out that this has involved a long list of publications and patents at the bottom there. And so just to acknowledge contributors, Colin Kavanagh for the magic work, and Marcus in particular, being responsible for that. And the high amylose wheat, Regina Ahmed has done a fantastic job, and I want to acknowledge our colleagues from Lima Grain as well in this work. And for those interested in the high amylose wheat story, the contact there is Elizabeth Seanleo at Lima Grain. So thanks very much.
Lovely work, Matthew, as always. Could I ask something that Melissa noted to me when she was looking at very, very high amylose rices, and they carried out human trials involving her and other friends eating some, and she said it was so high amylose it was really unpalatable, just stuck in her stomach for a day or so, and she just didn't feel like eating anything for a while. Do your high amylose wheat suffer from similar, what loosely might be called, organoleptic properties? I'm very proud of that word.
Yeah. So I think rice and wheat and other cereals are quite different. I mean, we like to think that starch is starch, but when we're talking high amylose, in Melissa's case, that was about 40-45%. So very different to this situation. But you've got to remember that rice is cooked by, you know, taking up water, and a lot of the organoleptic properties are around the swelling of that starch and so on. In the wheat case, we're using this in a very different way in terms of milling it. It has the gluten proteins integrally around the high amylose starch, and in fact it does make a very acceptable product. So I don't think we're running into the same roadblock that they have in rice.
That was really nice that you've got that triple null through natural there, Matthew. Very exciting. Just wondering what sort of products that you might have on the pipeline down the road.
Look, I think in terms of... I can't really think of, other than, say, an udon noodle or, you know, your waxy-type applications. I'm not thinking at this stage that there's a huge degree of limitation in where this can go. I think it's a new resource to have a look at and open some new doors. So I wouldn't put any constriction on your thinking about how to use it.
What is the survival rate of these transgenics, like both in the greenhouses, and have you tried putting them in the fields?
Yeah. We have done extensive field trialing, and they're extremely normal plants. Okay. So one of the differences, I guess, between the transgenic and the non-transgenic approach is that with the seed-specific promoter, the only place where the gene is down-regulated is in the grain. So the rest of the plant development is completely normal. And in fact, we see very little difference between the transgenic and the control in terms of its production characteristics. Of course, there's clearly a difference in its starch structure and grain functionality.
And one more question. Does it affect the yield at all? Like, have you done any replicated yield trials or something to compare the yields?
There's very little difference, as I said, with the transgenic.
Okay.
In fact, you know, statistically, it'd be very hard-pressed to show a difference. With the non-transgenic, I think it's a bit early to have that kind of statement, but looks okay.
Thank you.
Matthew, just for my curiosity, what is the source of those mutants? Are they natural mutants or irradiated?
No, so there are various sources of mutants that we'd use. I don't think it actually matters at the end of the day. It's the effect on the gene, but they're either chemical mutants or radiation-induced mutants. But you could, you know, we haven't... I don't think that's the critical factor. I think it's the effect on the gene.